written during or immediately after the Babylonian exile.
Yeah, that's right.
And I thought the reason, one of the reasons was because Satan is not mentioned in Tanakh.
As an entity. It's mentioned in Tanakh, but only in books.
Satan.
The Satan, the Satan. He's only mentioned as an entity, as a separate entity from God, in books that were written during the exile time. So you would only have that in Daniel,
mm-hmm.
and you would have it in, which is clearly exilic. You have it in Divrei Hayamim, which was written by Ezra after the Jews came back from the exile, and you have it here in Iyov, and those are the only places that you'll have it. Before that, it's either a malach or a person doing maaseh sitnut, which is acts of trouble, acts of conspiracy, acts of stoppage, acts of punishment, or very, however one the word Satan is difficult to translate even as a verb, but it's never, there never is such a being as the Satan before books that show up during the exilic period. That's the biggest proof that Iyov is written during the Babylonian period.
So when he does show up,
yeah.
it's as someone who makes trouble, is it?
In all three cases, yeah. If you take a look at David HaMelech, if you remember the part where David HaMelech goes and does a census. So in Malachim it says, and God instigated David to, and David, because he was angry with him, he instigated David. David does the census, and etc. etc.
Right.
In Divrei Hayamim it says
the Satan
instigates David.
Really?
Word for word.
I don't remember that.
Is it the Satan is King David?
No, the Satan instigates David.
Oh, instigates.
Yeah, I'll just read it quickly so you can see. In the end of Shmuel, during the counting, during the terrible census that David did, so it says.
No.
In Shmuel it says, Vayosef af Adonai v'charot Yisrael. God got very angry at Israel. Vayaset et David bahem lemor, and he instigated David towards them, saying, Lech mnei et Yisrael v'yat Yudah. Go and create a census. So God essentially is pushing David along. That's in Sefer Shmuel, written before the destruction of the temple. A parallel story exists in Divrei Hayamim by David. With the census, and it reads like this. Where is it? Is divided a little bit differently. It always takes me a little while to find it.
Tell you what, why don't I look at it and you go on?
Oh, here it is. Perchaf al Tiberi Yam Malach. Vayamod Satan al Yisrael. Satan rose up on Israel. Vayaset et David. And he instigated David. So there, you can see it's exactly the note that Yisrael, the count Israel. It's the same pasuk. It's word for word, except Ezra feels comfortable using the Satan version, or he changes that, or he changed God to Satan, because he was not comfortable with the idea of God instigating people to do evil. So again, the idea that one tries to remove the nasty part of God from God, not because they believe that God comes in two parts, but trying to distance God from the punishment of the exile. Well, what they were living through was the exile, and it was hard to, I'm sure it was very, just like it was difficult after the Holocaust for people to come to terms with God, and books and, you know, entire tombs were written about how could there be a God, where was God. I have no doubt that the same ideas were being written during the exile period. In fact, Sefer Iyov, that's exactly what Sefer Iyov is about. So too, when Ezra's writing his stuff, he's got to come to terms with that. So they create this thing called the Satan, which is a personification of God's destructive powers. But it creates a certain degree of separation. Later on, Christianity would evolve that into an entirely different being. And proto-Christianity, the deviant forms of Judaism, would also create a being out of the Satan, and that's why in much of the literature was actually suppressed at a later time, because the Christians had made the Satan a cause celebre, right? An outside force that caused man to do evil. Man is born evil, the original sin, all of those ideas. This was unfortunately an idea that was created probably by us. We created the Satan, of course, you can read in the literature, and by extending the Satan to be the sort of entity of God, you know, you open up the window a little bit and somebody cracks it all the way open. So it was probably, there was a certain risk involved, and unfortunately people fell into it. That's my opinion.
In human era, they never interchange Satan and Malach?
Never.
That's always Satan.
No, Yirmiyahu?
Yeah.
Yirmiyahu, the word Satan never shows up.
Never.
The concept of the devil as such is immaterial in Judaism compared to Christianity.
That's correct. But the idea of a satan, an evil, an aggressive force of God, I mean, we invented that. We invented the satan. Unfortunately, it sort of got away from us. You create stuff like that, and it sort of gets away from you. It becomes, because people are excited about stuff like that. People are always excited about the supernatural. And Tanakh doesn't really deal with the supernatural. It deals with the natural. How do people deal with people? And then how does God get involved in punishing you or benefiting you because of the way you dealt with people and the way you prayed to God? But it doesn't talk about hell. It doesn't talk about heaven. It doesn't talk about, right? The idea of heaven and hell are almost non-existent. And we're going to take a look at a few places of Eov where there's some flavors of it. The only place where hell is specifically mentioned right out. So you might say, well, what about Korach, who got swallowed up by the earth? Mm-hmm. But all it says is Sha'ol. Sha'ol is used as grave. Yaakov says, V'yirei tzevati Sha'ol, I will go down to my grave. He's not talking about hell. He doesn't think he's going to go to hell. Yaakov is not damning himself to hell. He says Sha'ol is a word for the grave. There's a hint of the underworld there, of course, but it's a literal statement. It's a phrase. Only Daniel. Bishol miyodelach. When I am in my grave, who will recognize you? Now, if you want to be flavorful, you could translate that as, we say that in Tachanun, right? Bishol miyodelach. Yagati Ashvei l'man chastecha, ke'im b'mavet zechrecha. Oh, there's the proof. Ke'im b'mavet zechrecha, because in death I will not recall you. I will not speak about you. Bishol, in Shol, mi yodelach. Nobody will admit that you exist. Nobody will identify you. Nobody will confirm you. So there the word Shol is being compared to mavet, death. It's not to hell.
Well,
if you want
more a life after death.
No. But
I mean,
mavet. No, that's what he's saying. He's saying, when you're dead, I cannot talk anymore. That's exactly the issue. When
right.
I'm dead, my mouth is permanently closed.
But if there was no sort of life after death, there wouldn't be an issue of whether I could do it or not do it, is the point.
No, I don't see it that way. I see when I die, I'm not going to be able to... What you're
when
saying
you
is,
die,
let me
you're
live.
Either nothing, you decay and go into the earth, or you are an entity that is no longer able to do what you can do when you're alive.
Yeah, you could read it that way, but that's not the simple meaning of the pasuk. The meaning of the pasuk is, please don't let me die. How does it go?
It's not
going to
do you any good.
Because when I go down, I'm not going to be able to do what I promised. Well, it's also a promise. It means if you don't kill me, I promise to confirm you. So it's, you know, you're promising, and you're also, it's a very chutzpahdik phrase, to be honest. You know, don't kill me, because if you do, you get nothing out of it. You know, that's
mm-hmm.
it's a chutzpahdik thing to say, but we're chutzpahdik people.
Mm-hmm.
It is,
and it's an important approach. I don't know if we didn't have David HaMelech helping us out with it, we may have felt uncomfortable. I'm not sure you'll find that stuff in Christian literature. I'm not an expert in Christian literature,
mm-hmm.
but I doubt they have anything quite that chutzpahdik. I wonder how they translate this verse, actually, because it's a little rough.
Mm-hmm.
They probably translate it as hell. But the simple translation for Sha'ol is not hell. The only place where you really come confront hell and the afterlife is in Daniel. And again, there you're in very late literature, and things have sort of... And what's important to realize, by the way, it doesn't mean Judaism doesn't believe in the afterlife. Torah Baal Peh talks about the afterlife quite a bit. And what's the proof? The proof is you can't have this many pages that avoid what every other religion in the entire world at that time, before this time, and after that time all believed. Everybody believed in the underworld. The Egyptians had Osiris, the one who would go down and be reborn. And they had the river Styx. And everybody, the basic tenets of religion, of the need for religion, really, I don't want to put it in terms of the negative, but the very need for religion is for man to know that he has an eternal soul. So to say that Judaism doesn't talk about it, therefore it didn't believe it, is preposterous. And you get that, by the way, a little bit with Kugel. In Kugel's book, he wrote a book called The God of Old. Just because we don't talk about it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. In fact, Konfuket, the fact that it's not mentioned in any one of these 1,000 pages, even though every other religion talks about it endlessly.
In the Gemara,
yes, but never in the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, means that the intent was to avoid it, because the Torah was not a book of the written Torah, not the oral Torah. The oral Torah was talking about the afterlife, but the written Torah was not... The whole idea of being written is it has a physical format. It's a guidebook on how to live in this world, not how to live in the next world.
Tradition of Heskel, is that really intimate?
I want you to know something. The dry bones is in Gemara Chelak, which is the famous Gemara at the end of Sanhedrin, which talks about resurrection. They bring down 50 different psukim where you could get a sense that there's resurrection. Never once is the dry bones brought down as a pasuk, for the very simple reason, because they use it as because everybody recognized that Yechezkel was talking not about a resurrection of dead people, but a resurrection of the Jewish people after the exile. What's interesting, but what's fascinating is they'll take psukim which really don't talk directly about resurrection and say, oh, there's a little bit of resurrection in here, but they won't take the pasuk that's the most obvious one to talk about resurrection, which is the dry bones, because they knew that the dry bones was Yecheskel, not what Yecheskel meant, not at all. I know today, and of course in Christological forces, they've taken that to mean resurrection, and then we sort of readopted it. So I think if you ask a common schoolboy about the idea of the dry bones, they'll tell you it's about Tchiyat HaMetim, and Chazal reject that idea totally, even though they obviously don't reject the idea of Tchiyat HaMetim. So it's an important idea that the, I don't know how we got, how did we get into this? I got lost. How do we get it? I mean, it's an interesting, I guess
tangents.
It's an interesting issue, but what?
A lot of tangents.
Yeah, a lot of tangents today. Although it's important about Eov. In Eov, you won't see anything about no devil. You won't see anything. You'll see God and Eov and the world around him. And there'll be some real issues. It looks like Eov is hinting at the idea of an afterlife, and we'll have to analyze those psukim carefully, because really an afterlife and reward in the world to come is studiously avoided by Tanakh writings, not because it didn't exist, because that's not what the Tanakh is about. Tanakh is about living in this world. What comes afterwards, but the famous Mishnah, I don't serve God because he'll reward me, I serve God even if he won't reward me, and that pretty much defines the Tanakh. How do you live in this world? Forget about what happens in the next world. And that's, I think, a very important approach to understanding Tanakh, and it's not a fundamentalist approach. Fundamentalists, especially Christians, don't take it like that, and I think they do the Tanakh a disservice. Okay. What safe are we doing? I think we're doing Eov. Okay, that... we did a little bit about the Satan, that was last week. So I want to go to Eov and start from the first psukim, because we talked about authorship, we talked about timing of authorship. That's how we got into it, the whole issue with the Satan. I said that it was probably an exilic book, and there are many opinions in Chazal and the Gemara itself which put it in exilic times. So it's certainly a firm idea. Even though the Gemara seems to say Moshe Rabbeinu ultimately was the author, you can see there are tons of opinions all over the place, and certainly it's well within our firm right to we follow the Gemara if we hold that it is an exilic book, and it could mean that it was just based on Moshe's work, which, as we'll see, it is, much later, though. We'll see it a little bit today if we get to it. But I want to look at the first few psukim. I still want to find out where it takes place. I need, if I want to understand the story, and what's interesting is, it actually gives us a location. Yishaya be'eretz Utz, Eov Shemo. There was a man in the land of a place called Utz, that's Oz. I don't want to go there, right? There's a man who lived in Oz, in Utz. This is in verse 1. Eov Shemo, his name was Eov. Aya Ishahu Tam V'Yashar, he was pure, he was straight. Yirei Elohim.
But he wasn't Jewish.
He wasn't Jewish. Definitely not Jewish. In fact, the Gemara will go out of its way to prove that it wasn't Jewish. V'sar Meiran, he never did anything bad. So it starts off right there. And right there you think, well, I have all the material I now need to know where my setting is. And obviously if the author, if the Navi here... whether Eov is a Sefer Nevuah or not, we'll come to terms with later. There are various opinions, but it's certainly a Sefer Kedusha, and it was being written either by a Navi or by a Chacham. If he's putting it in a time and place, then the assumption is that a time and a place is significant. Now, if it was all an invented story, that it's all a parable, like the Rambam says, then it wouldn't make a difference where Utz was, and it wouldn't make a difference where what Eov meant. Those are the two issues. What does the name mean, and what does... and what does you know, where does he live? So if it's all a made up story, it doesn't really matter at all.
Why does the Rambam have an issue with it?
He doesn't. He just believes it's a parable top to bottom. He just believes it's all it's a story about you know, it's an impossible story. The entire thing top to bottom is woven for the sake of teaching a lesson. What we and these, this is a valid opinion. What we came up with is a different opinion. I proved that Eov was a real guy. The story, the terrible story that happens to him, was invented because he was known as an incredibly righteous person who was able to stand against pain and punishment, and therefore they used Eov as a foil around which they wrote their Sefer. So what we said essentially was that the story in the whole middle section is invented. Not invented, but I want to say constructed. But the person Eov is real. But if I'm taking a real person, give me a time and place. He tells us what the time and place is, so where is it? So also you should know about Eov, even if he is real, the name is usually quite significant. That is, people are often named in Tanakh or after what they are, not probably their original names. I don't know if Eov's original name was Eov. And this is not a surprising idea. It comes up quite clearly in Ruth, right? She was married to a guy named Machlon, and which means, you know, disease. And as her sister Orpah was married to Kilion, which means destruction. So Avimelech named his kids Death and Destruction. He probably did. I don't know. Their names were probably Shmuley and Moshe, probably. The names are obviously being created to set a tone. The question is, here's another example. Naval HaKarmeli, he's the guy who cheats David out. David does a lot of guard duty for him, and Naval tells him that he doesn't deserve anything. Get away from me. What's mine is mine. What's yours is mine. Everything is mine. And he's called Naval. Naval means, you know, dead body, you know, or a terrible thing. That's being reworked. And what's the real proof? The other guy to say the exact same words as Naval, what's yours is mine, what's mine is mine, was Lavan, which is Naval spelled backwards. And you can see that the words are exactly the same. And these are, you know, we even see specifically Tzidkiyahu was renamed by Melech Bavel. That wasn't his original name. It actually says specifically that Bavel changed his name to Tzidkiyahu at the end of Menachem. Why Melech Bavel would want to do something like that is a separate story. But here you have situations where names are being changed specifically, Avram and Abraham. Mm-hmm. So even though those aren't very big name changes, there's a significance there. A lot of times you don't have name changes, you have a name given specifically for a purpose. For instance, Noach. Why does Noach get his name? The Torah says, Zeyinachameinu Meetzbonyaneinu. Meetzbonyaneinu. He will comfort us from the troubles or the sadness or the sins of our own hands. They named him Noach. By the way, you should know, Zeyin Nachameinu can be one of two forms. It could either be a prophecy form, he will give us comfort, or let him give us comfort, like long live the king. You see, there are two ways to understand it. Rashi actually takes the non-prophetic way. He says it was a request. What's called the justice. It's a desire for it to happen, not prophecy, because they didn't figure that Noah's father was a prophet. Different opinions. What's interesting, by the way, you have to be careful when you're renaming things. If his really name is being named after the fact that he's going to be Menachem people, then his name shouldn't be Noah at all. It should be what?
Menachem
or Nachum. Mm-hmm. Right? Here's another example of somebody getting a name. Shaul gets his name. Sorry, not Shaul, Shmuel. Shmuel kimei Hashem she'il tiv, because he has been borrowed for God. She'il tiv, which means his name should have been Shmuel, it should have been Shaul, but I guess they didn't want to confuse him with the king. You see what I'm saying? But kimei Hashem she'il tiv, and therefore I call his name Shmuel. And you're thinking, where'd the mem come from? That doesn't make any sense. Well, what you're really seeing here is two things. One is you have to be careful with the naming. Very often the name that we see does not exactly match the intention.
Could the name be given later on and then retroactively used?
I believe the name could be given in the following places. Either it could be given by the people who are giving birth to the child, and therefore they want to give him a name specifically, or it's a name changed by between God and the person himself, Abraham, Yehoshua, Hosea, mm-hmm. or it's being changed by the people around him, not by God, but by circumstances. For instance, or it could be changed by himself to fit a certain goal. For instance, the two kings that divided the kingdom, one is Rechav Am, my kingdom is wide, and the other one is Yerav Am, let my kingdom be great, Rav Am. My guess is they took the names in contrast to each other. Another example is Achav. There was a great king named Achav who was king at the same time of northern Israel, who was married to Jezebel and was a terrible sinner. And at the same time you had a guy named Yehoshaphat. Achav has a son named Yehoram who takes the throne. Yehoshaphat's son is also named Yehoram who rules at the same time. So the chances of that's not a coincidence. Somebody changed their name at some point to make a point. No, because they weren't related at that point, right? One's northern king and one's southern king. No, I think it was done because it indicated a reunification of the state of Israel.
But in the case where the parent giving a child a name, the parent can give a child a name and the child is not necessarily when the child is born also.
That's correct. Could rename the child at a later point.
They
absolutely.
See the child's characteristics. Yes.
You're absolutely correct. And the person may rename himself, God may rename him. And finally, the author, I believe that every prophetic author has a right to do a little renaming to make sure that his point is clear. Such as Machlon and Kilia.
It was easy in those days. They didn't issue precedence.
That's correct, yeah. And you know what? People change their names now. If somebody gets sick, what do we add to the Jewish name? If somebody gets sick, Chayo or
Chayim,
Rafael. So this is a common Jewish idea. I don't think it's shocking to say that Eov's name may or may not have been Eov. In this case, it may very well have been Eov, because as we saw, Yechezkel mentions the three big non-Jews who were righteous, Dan-El, Eov, and Noach. So Eov may in fact have been his name, but as we'll see, even if it was his name, he may have taken it for a certain purpose. So with that in mind, the question is, what is Eov mean? It's not very clear what it means. So Chazal threw out an idea. Eov zesh Hashem haya oyev lo. He was an enemy to him. Eov, oyev. It's a little difficult, though, because God wasn't really an enemy to him. That's not the point of the story. Well, yes, but they're playing with words. The question is, does Chazal really mean that's what the name means, or are they trying to be homiletic? So I want to leave Eof off for a second. Probably only do about half of what I attended, but Gamzu Utova. The second issue, Utz. Utz is much more solid, the Eretz Utz. While a name could be changed, a land, not so sure that that's easily changeable. So the question is, does the land give some clue about where, what exactly the setting is? So there, I've got, I've quoted for you at the top, see where it says Utz on the top of the page? So if you take a look, I'll quote to you from Bereshit. We have two interesting possibilities. One is in Bereshit Yud. Uvnei Aram, Utz, V'chul, V'geter, U'mash, I believe, which means one of the children of Aram was Utz. And of course, all these places, Aram became a place, many of these places became, what we're talking about is the very early generations in Bereshit, where many of these people, you have Midian shows up there, you've got all kinds of, you know, these are the names of the people that will later form the 70 nations. So right away, Aram becomes a possibility. Now, Aram puts us, of course, in as the Arameans, and that puts us in anywhere from Syria up to lower Turkey, and then through the Mesopotamia into Assyria. Mostly Syria, the Syria and southern Turkey area, right before you get into Asia Minor. However, there's another Utz. Take a look in Bereshit, Perikov, I'm sorry, here's another proof for Aram. So it was after these things. Now I'm going to ignore what those things are. If you recognize it, that's fine. It's going to be a big issue later in the Shia. Vayugad la'Avram le'mor, hine yalda nulka gamhi banim v'nachor achicha. Your brother's sister also gave birth. Et Utz b'choro, the b'chor's name was Utz. Ve'et buz achiv, ve'et k'muel avi Aram. So Aram actually is being used again as a grandson of Nahor. And Utz shows up, but of course, don't forget, Nahor, like Avram, was an Aramite. They were from Syria. They were Aramean, right? Arami Oved Avi, which either means an Arami tried to destroy my father, but Ebenezer correctly rejects that. And Arami Oved Avi, he says, Arami, my father was lost in Aram until he came to Israel. And as we know, they're Arameans. We know that Nahor was Aramite. We know that we're Aramaic. You know, it's not such a bad thing.
A link potentially in Avram and Yo.
Yeah, we'll see that very much. You just blew my whole shit.
No.
There's a tremendous link between Eof and well, you know, not only family-wise, but philosophically. That is, I believe one of the keys to unlocking all of Sefer Eof is to see the connection between Avram, what exactly the connection is. You may notice, Vayechi Achar Dvarim Eilu, do you know what Dvarim just took place before this?
Wasn't that the
Akedah? Akedah Yitzhak, exactly right. Where he's asked to sacrifice everything. So we'll see. That's going to be very crucial in understanding Eof, in my opinion. As I didn't invent it.
Utz was the firstborn
of Nahor. Yeah. And he was also one of the children of the original Aram, which is, you know, a thousand years before Nahor.
So Utz could be in the land where Utz lived.
That's correct. Absolutely right. Or the land that was named after.
Uh-huh.
Usually the lands got their names.
Right.
For instance, Shechem. Shechem was named after Avi Shechem, Hamor, and Avi Shechem. Very often the names of the lands were named after, I don't know,
the leaders.
Yeah, I mean, like, we do it today. We have Vills, I don't know, Brownsville. Very often names are named after, I guess there was nobody named Orange, but I'm sure a lot of places around
there.
There was.
Orange.
There was a Prince or Duke
Prince
of Orange.
Oh, was there? Okay.
In England.
But he was named after Orange, which was a place, I think, in Netherlands.
Right.
Yeah, but it's all there.
Yeah, York,
there,
right? New York.
It's
so, this is very common. It was true in biblical times, true today. So here we have proof that it's Aram, and in fact, that's one possibility. The second possibility, of course, is Utz shows up again in Bereshit Lamed Vav. Now this is where it's going through Toldot Esav, who Edom, Eila bnei Seir Achori Yoshvei Aretz. These are the children of Seir, Lotan v'Shoval v'Tzivon va'ana. So pay attention to Tzivon. The Eila b'nei Tzivon, I'm skipping a few psukim just to get to the Utz. Eila b'nei Tzivon, ayav ana, hu ana, asher matzah et yamim b'midbar, v'ra'ato et ha'chamorim l'tzivon aviv. There's a little family history there of Esau. The Eila b'nei ana, doshan v'ahalivama u'bat ana. So we get a girl's name, that's always significant. The Eila b'nei Dishon, chemda v'asban v'yitron v'uchran, I'm not sure I'm reading this right, ele b'nei etzer, bilhan v'zon v'akan, ele b'nei dishan, utz, there we go, there's dishan's kid, utz varan. So there we're talking about a great-grandson of Esav. So now we've got an interesting situation. Both of them fit geographically, because if you remember, they're attacked by the Kazdim, which is from the south, that would be from Arabia, and they're also attacked from the east by the Chaldeans, by the Kazdim. Aram fits because both of them are directly over the Jordan River, with Aram being towards the north, the Golan Heights further up to Syria, and Edom being around where the Dead Sea is and below into Saudi Arabia. Both fit. I would say probably Edom fits a little bit better, but both become quite a possibility. So from this point, it's not really clear which Utz it is. And by the way, while this seems like a small point, from the small point, we're going to get to a very big point. The other proof that it seems to be Edom is if you take a look in Eicha. Eicha is where Eretz Utz actually is mentioned. Sisi v'simchi bat Edom. That's in the fourth paragraph down, starting with Eicha Perigdala. Be happy, be joyous, the daughters of Edom. Yoshevet be'eretz Utz, those who dwell in the land of Utz. Damalecha ta'avor kos, the cup will spill on you. Tishkari v'titari, you get drunk, you'll get yours. Essentially, that's what he's saying. You're laughing about the fact that we're getting ours. You know, I was saying about destruction of Yerushalayim, wait till you get yours. So there it's quite clear that Eretz Utz and Bat Edom are being compared. Now we have a little bit of an issue. Which one do I go with? Is it Edom, or is it Edom, or is it Aram? So if you take a look, skip Yirmiyahu for right now. Oh, by the way, the Yirmiyahu, which is the fifth paragraph down, seems to come up against the idea that it might be Edom. Why? If you take a look at the underlined section, he's talking about all the nations that are going to get theirs. So it says Ve'et Kol Ha'arav, Ve'et Kol Malchei Eretz Utz, and then if you go back to Chaf Aleph, it says Ve'et Edom, Et Edom. That would seem to indicate that Utz is not Edom. So the question is, I got two for Aram, I got two for Edom, and I got one really anti-Edom. And that last one, I think, is a key issue when it comes to the commentators. Take a look at what Rashi says. Yishaya be'eretz Utz, perish be'eretz Aram. So he says he doesn't entertain the Edom possibility. It's definitely Aram, k'mo d'chtiv, et Utz b'chorom, and b'nei Nachor. So that was what we said. Now here's something very interesting that happens, by the way. V'haya ha'ish, I'm still in Rashi, v'haba ha'ish ahu gadol mikol b'nei kedem, he was greater than, this is in Eov, he was greater than all the people of the East. Probably it's talking about in wealth. B'nei Eretz HaMizrachi, that's the land in the East. Sha'aram b'mizracho shel olam, because that's Aram Naharayim, from Syria all the way down into the, all the way down to the Gulf, and that was considered the East of the world. So there we prove that Aram is the eastern areas. But of course that could apply to Edom also. So my question is, why is Rashi studiously avoiding the Edom possibility? Why is it maybe Edom? And if you notice, he gives two other possibilities. I'm skipping one possibility that I didn't include here, which is a more difficult possibility, but if you notice, it says Davar Acher, you see that Dalet Aleph, Be'eretz Utz, Be'eretz Shenot Li Mimenu Eitzot Ra'ot. Utz is not a real place, it's a place where they give bad advice. So here he's going more in the Rambam's meaning that Utz is not a real place, it's a fictitious place that's coming to prove a point of the author. What ma'itza shenatlu? What was the bad advice that they took? Shayu Omrim, they say, lo kol yemenu litol to elyonim. It's not fair that God takes everything above, v'litein lano et atochdom, and all he gives us is what's down below. Elu bo'ol le'eret shinar, go to Mesopotamia, shesham elohut harbei, because there you'll find many gods. He's quoting a medrash, and this medrash seems to come out of the blue. How does this help out? What are they trying to say about this land of Utz? So, a question for you: does it remind you of anybody? Somebody who started off in Aram and then went to Bavel, to Eretz Shinar, to find many, many gods. It may remind you of somebody. What does it remind you of? Avram. Not so much Avram, but Terach. Exactly right. And that connection is going to be over and over again. Let's take a look at Ebenezer. Ebenezer says something that's really mind-blowing, so I'd like to read it to you. Eov, Shehayim ibnei banav shel Nachor. So first of all, he comes out flat on the side of Arameans. Achi Avraham, Vakarov Eli, but actually what I really prefer, Shehayim ibnei Esav. It just changed his mind. It's a very strange lashon, to be honest. I feel like maybe the Ebenezer, our version of Ebenezer may not be accurate. Well, look at it again. It's very difficult, Eben Ezra. Hayam mibanav shel Nachor achi Avraham. He seems to be saying it as a fact. These are Arameans. These are from Nachor's family. Vakarov alai, what appears to me, this is actually from Edom. Doesn't sound right, right? What I thought maybe might have been the original one is he might have said, and Rashi, well, actually, he wouldn't know about Rashi if he lived at the same time as Rashi. He might be saying, there are those who say that he's Aramean, about Karov Elai. I get the feeling that perhaps some of the Eben Ezra was cut off here, because it sounds like he's being contradictory, and since he's coming out in favor of Edom in the end, then it must be that, I feel like there's a few missing words at the beginning, like there are those who say Yesh Omrim, right. Something like that. I don't know that for sure. You'd have to go to original scrolls of Eben Ezra if you could find them to really see whether there's a possibility, but something doesn't flavor right. But he's certainly coming out clearly at the end in favor of Edom. V'akarov elai shayim v'ei Esav v'anyan mochiach be'eretz utz k'mo sisi simchi bat Edom yoshevet be'eretz utz. He brings down Eicha, he says it's obvious. Edom Utz, you can't miss it. V'lo yitachein shelo haya ba'olam. And don't tell me that it doesn't exist. So he talks about that idea, he comes out against the Rambam, even though he didn't know the Rambam, he comes against that idea that is a fictional character. Now here he says something really weird. And now, by the way, we have this conflict. Eben Ezra has his psukim, Rashi has his psukim, and each one will answer the other guy's psukim. By the way, what does Rashi do with Eicha? Very simple. When it says Sichi v'Simchi Bat Edom, the Eretz Utz, he means that's Bat Edom, and Eretz Utz is Aram. So it's not the same country, biblical parallelism, but it's another thing. It's much more difficult than the Eben Ezra. The simple pshat of the pasuk is they're both talking about Aram. I think the answer, by the way, may be in the following. Rashi must be influenced by Yirmiyahu, which says Kol Eretz Utz and Edom. And therefore, if you say Eretz Utz and Edom, it can't be that Eretz Utz is the same as Edom. But here you have to be careful. Please take a look back on Bereshit Perek Lamed Vav. That's the third paragraph down. There are two Edoms. There's Edom and Seir.
What's going to say? Isn't Edom at a completely different location geographically than Utz could be?
No, because it could be across the river to the south as opposed to across the river to the north. What are you asking?
The
Jordan River.
Okay.
Jordan River.
Okay, all right.
They're both across the Jordan River. If you go north, you get to Aram. If you go south, you get to Edom. But they're both in reasonable locations as far as the story setting goes. Both satisfy. The problem with Yirmiyahu is he says Eretz Utz, and he says Edom, clearly stating that Eretz Utz is not Edom. I think what Eben Ezra would answer to this, although I haven't seen it inside, is very simple. Edom itself was two separate countries. There was Edom, which had a Melech Edom, and then you had Alufei Seir. Take a look very carefully. It says, Ela Toldot Esav, Hu Edom. That's where it starts off. But all the way in Parak Chaf, we're talking about Ela B'nei Seir Achori. And it says, if you take a look in Pasuk Lamed, Aluf Dishon, Aluf Etzar, Aluf Dishon, Ela Alufei Achori, La Alfeyem, Be'eretz Seir. So you should know there were actually two separate countries. One was Seir and one was Edom. One was a monarchy and one was a whole bunch of Alufim, which were generals. My guess is that what the Eben Ezra would say is, yeah, I agree with you that Utz is not Edom, but Utz is probably Seir, which is actually further off into the mountains, which makes sense because he clearly had a lot of sheep and he would need the space. The bottom line is, it's hard to say really which one to go to. We've got the Eben Ezra, we've got the Rashi, and really does it make a difference? Who cares? I'll show you why we care in a second, because the Eben Ezra says something unbelievable afterwards. And here's where we get back to the name. You see where it says the three dots and then it says Va'omer? V'ha'omer shehu Yovav ben Zerach mi Batzra. Somebody who says it's Yovav ben Zerach mi Batzra. Why Eov? Yovav. Eov, Yovav. Not impossible to connect those two things. For instance, you should know very often last letters are doubled. For instance, we have the word Am, but we also have Amame, right? We have Chatzotzerot, sometimes once, sometimes twice, I believe. What's another word that has a... There are many words where we lose the... mar. What, how do you say bitter?
Mar.
But how do you say something that is a bitter item? Is maror, right? So, elim merire. So very often you have the last letter that gets doubled up, that you lose the doubling of the letter because people are lazy. They swap off the last repeated syllable, the last repeated word. So apparently Eov is being somebody, we don't know who this is, I'm sorry, somebody, Vaha Omer, those who say that he's Yovav. Now who is Yovav? Yovav is mentioned in Eretz Edom. Take a look in Bereishit Perek Lamed Vav Lamed Aleph. It's right below this. It says Ve'ela Hamalachim Asher Malchu BeEretz Edom Lifnei Malach Melech Lifnei Yisrael. Before there was a king in Israel. Vayimloch BeEdom Bela Ben Baor. Don't confuse it with Balach Ben Baor. This is Bela Ben Baor of Edom. V'Shem Yiro Din Hava. Vayama Bela Vayimloch Tachtav Yovav Ben Zerach Mi Batzrai. He was a king of Edom. So wait a second. Why is Ebenezer getting so upset about it? Ebenezer liked the whole idea about it was Edom in the first place, although I already explained that it wasn't probably Edom, it was probably Seir, which were the suburbs of Edom. They were the non-monarchy. But still, why is Ebenezer flipping out about this? Wait, see, go back to Ebenezer, you'll see how sharp he is. Va'omesh hu Yovav ben Zerach mi Batzra. Anybody who says that Eov is Yovav, Shema b'chalom ra'azeh, he probably dreamed it up in a dream. Ki ein lo ama yish'an, he has nothing to rely on. Lo al divrei Nevi'im, the Nevi'im don't say such a thing. V'lo al mashe etiku chachmenu zal, and not which our Chazal have said. Va'al titamel milo, period. There's like this diatribe, and we don't know why he's diatribing. Like, what's the big deal? So somebody says it's Yovav, and not only that, it agrees with your opinion that it's in the Edom area. So what are you flipping out for? And what's interesting, by the way, is Yovav actually appears twice. Once by Edom, and then if you take a look at the last source, we go back to Parashat Perek Yud. Yovav shows up again as Bnei Yachtan, who is a child of Aram. What's the problem? It satisfies everybody. You want to believe it's Aram? Why can't Eov be Yovav? What's the big deal? So here's where you have to know something that Ebenezer knew that we don't necessarily know. And here's where I'm going to ask you to go to the English page. The LXX chapter 42. The LXX is the Septuagint. It's the Targum Shivim. The Targum Shivim was written for Jews by Jews. It was the original art scroll. The original art scroll. The first art scroll there was the Targum Shivim. Now, you have to be careful when you read the Targum Shivim. As I said, it was written for Jews by Jews. And there was a famous story about how Ptolemy forced the 70 people to go into the... It's a Midrashic story, and there's probably a lot of truth to it. But also the Jews at the time in Egypt started to lose their Hebrew capabilities, just like we in America have, and they needed a translation. It was written really for Jews by Jews. The translation was probably about as good as the Art Scrolls. And the problem is that our oldest versions of the Septuagint come from the 3rd century CE. It was written in the 3rd century BCE, but our earliest version of the 3rd century CE, and what that means is that the oldest version of the Septuagint we have are written by Christians, because the Christians felt that Greek was a holy language, and the Septuagint was actually revealed as a holy language to start Christianity at the dawn of Christianity. What that means is you will have Christological modifications of the Septuagint. You'll have the name Jesus that simply just shows up. You'll have the Savior, the Man, the Son of God, stuff like this. 99% of the time, you're not going to see stuff like that. But you always have to be curious when you're reading stuff in the Septuagint. Is that the original translation, or was that the hand of one of the early church fathers in the first, second, third century who inserted Christological words into it to help their beliefs over the Jews? With that warning in mind, you should keep in mind that again, 99.99% is purely Jewish translation. And it has some interesting things here. And there was born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. This matches our text exactly. And he called the first Yemima, which is Jemima. Always makes people laugh. At the very end of our Sefer, it also says the same thing, by the way. If you open up the end of Eov, it says the same thing. So whenever you read Eov, you tend to think of, I always think of, remember those commercials with the syrup? There was Aunt Jemima with the headscarf. So I always think of Aunt Jemima. With the tichel and the... Right? The second was Kizian. The third was Karen Afuch. This is from our text. And there was not found in comparison with the daughters of Job, fairer women than they were all the world, and their father gave them inheritance among their brothers. This is exactly what we have in our text. And Job lived after his affliction 170 years, and all the years he lived with 240, and Job saw his sons and his sons' sons to the fourth generation. Let me just check to see if that's our exact text. If you have Eov, you might want to just take a look at the very last words of Eov. Let's confirm that the Septuagint has those words exactly.
679.
Pasuk Yud Gimel at the very end. Vayhilo Shivana Banim Shalosh Benodi, had 7 sons and 3 daughters. Vayikra Shema Achat Yemima, of course they call the first one Jemima. Vashema Shini Ktsiya Vashema Shlishi Karen Afoch. See, it's exactly the same thing. Velo Nimsad Nashim Yafot Kivnot Iyov Chol Aretz. You never found such beautiful women like his daughters in all the land. See that? Exactly the same. Now, it was 140 years, by the way, do you see that? Four generations. And he died in a good old age. So we know that he lived 140 years. And take a look back at our text. Here he said 240. Do you see that change? First change, 240, not 140.
Where's the
240? No, it
starts at 170. And in the end, because the assumption is that all of this happened in 70 years. Because it has the story starting in his 70th year. So where did they get this number 240 from? Is this made up? I'll show you soon. And Job and his sons of four generations, that's exact. But now, and Job died an old man full of days. That's great. But it doesn't stop there, the Septuagint. It has a little epilogue. And it goes like this. And it is written that he will rise again with those whom the Lord raises up. Now, your bet is as good as mine whether this could be Jewish also. You know, it's impossible to say at this point who added in. There are three possibilities. It's our original source, but it was not included as part of the Sifrei Kodesh. It may have been just an addendum to the story that the LXX, the Targum Shivim Tzadik, put in. It could be modified. It could be that the Septuagint took it from the writings of the Qumran caves. These are sectarian Jews who were probably, I don't want to say they were early Christians, because they're before early Christianity, but much of their philosophies would develop into later Christianity. These are the sectarians that we found their documents in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the third possibility is actually talking about, you know, the resurrection of you-know-who. It's hard to say whether this verse is Christian, deviant Jewish, or actually old non-Kodesh Jewish. It's hard to say. And therefore, again, we have to be very careful. But it adds some interesting stuff. This man is described in the Syriac book, don't know what that is, as living in the land of Utz, Asus is Utz, on the borders of Edom and Arabia. So there it puts it solidly in Edom. It takes a clear position. Not Aram, but Edom. And his name before was Yovav. There we go, directly Yovav. And having taken an Arabian wife, he begot a son whose name was Enon, etc., etc., etc. So now you know where it all came from, by the way. He knew the Targum Shivim. He was no idiot. He was a scholar. And he knew that people were quoting the Targum Shivim as saying that the name was Yovav. And essentially what Eben Ezra is saying to you is this text here, discard it completely. It's not our Sefer Kodesh. I have no idea who put it in. You probably felt the Christians put it in. Take the whole thing out. But interesting, it comes out on the side of Edom. However, we have a second text that is worth taking a look at. Oh, by the way,
places the whole events at the time of Avraham. Basically.
That's correct. Uh-huh. That's right. The fifth son of Avraham. That's exactly right. And by the way, so the first thing, by the way, the 240 years, where did they get that from? So I quote you a Gemara. I'm going to do it outside just so we don't run overtime. The Gemara says that Eov lived, we learned that Eov lived the exact amount of years that the Jews were in Egypt. How long the Jews were in Egypt? 210 years. It was not 240, it was 210 years. So that's where, I think that's where they're getting closer to that number, if not 240. That's the only way I can imagine that age came from.
That matches the text in Eov, which is he lived
140 plus
70
is 210. You're right. It matches our text and not the Septuagint text. That's correct. The next thing I want to read to you actually is much more dangerous. This is the Testament of Job. The Testament of Job is in the Pseudepigrapha. This is not included even in the Christian Bible. This was considered what we consider the apocryphal text, like the Book of the Maccabees. So we believe that it was written by Jews, but we put it outside of our Bible. We believe in what we call the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha that we put outside, like the Book of the Maccabees and the Book of Jubilees, was included, not the Book of Jubilees, the Book of the Maccabees and the Book of Judith, were included in the actual Bible by the Christians. They have the Catholics, but they left out certain books of dubious origin, such as this book, Testament of Job. And Testament of Job has all kinds of interesting stories about Job. The question is, who wrote it? As you read the book, it's not, but there are definitely Christological effects in it. The earliest copy that we have is 6th century CE, a Coptic Christian version, which means Egypt, the Coptic Christians in Egypt. This is a very early form of Christianity. They're clearly in the Testament of Job. It's not a Christian work, but they're clearly insertions of Christianity. However, scholars believe that the book was actually written 100 years before the Common Era, before Jesus' time, and it had Jewish authorship just like almost every book of the Pseudepigrapha. It was rejected by the rabbis as a Stam story. And as I read it to you, you'll see how idiotic it is. However, there's some interesting truths to it. So let me read it to you, and I think you'll find it actually kind of funny. You'll see immediately why it's not a Sefer Kodesh. You'll see why the Chazal rejected it. On the day he became sick, and he knew that he would leave his bodily abode, this is talking about Eov, he called his 7 sons and 3 daughters, right, now you know who it is, together, and he spake to them as follows. By the testament means the last will and testament, right? This is what he gives his kids. Form a circle around me, children, and hear. You see, it's all is what's called pseudepigraphal, because the author of the book is no longer somebody writing about Eov, it's Eov himself. That's why it's called pseudepigraphal. The author is fake. And I shall relate to you what the Lord did for me and all that happened to me. For I am Job, your father. Know ye, my children, that you are the generation of the chosen one, and take heed of your noble birth. Right, here you get Christian ideas. For I am the son of Esau. So there it follows the Septuagint. You see, it puts it in Edom. My brother is, but here now it's really confusing. My brother is Nahor, and your mother is Dinah. This only shows up here, but some of you may actually know the Medrash. What does the Medrash say? It says, remember when Eov gets angry at his wife and he says, you speak like one of the Nivalot? So Chazal say that means that it was none other that he was married to Dinah. It's here, by the way, if you want to take a look. I don't want to take the time to do it now, but Chazal also have one opinion in Chazal that say it was the time of Yaakov. Actually, if you want to, take a look at the page that starts with Talmud Bavli. At the very top of the page where it says Talmud Bavli, up here, what does it say? Yemei shnotav shel Eov maaseh shenichnasu Yisrael l'mitzrayim. I'm sorry, next line. Yesh omrim Eov bimei Yaakov haya v'dina bat Yaakov nasa. He married Dina bat Yaakov. How do we know that? Because it says in Eov kidaber achat ha-nevalot tidaberi. You're talking like one of the nevalot. And it says by Dina, after she got raped, ki nevala asa b'Yisrael. So before we totally toss away the testament of Eov, you should know that Chazal have a similar Masorah. That is, there's probably a Masorah of old kind of homiletic stories, which are diverging into Chazal's literature and diverging into this Testament of Job written around the time of Chazal, very early times of Chazal. So here, can you see, before we toss away the Testament of Job as a totally fake sefer, you see that Chazal also agree, there's opinion in Chazal that says that Dina was in fact Eov's wife. Now, let's continue on. I am a very rich man living to the east of Utz, and before the Lord God, his name be Job, I was called Yovav. So there, too, it keeps the Masorah of Yovav, which obviously is being rejected by the Menasher. But here's where it starts to get fun. And I'll be finished in 3 and 4 minutes. The beginning of my trial was thus. Near my house there was an idol of one worshipped by the people. And I constantly saw burnt offerings brought to him as a god. By the way, the guy he's talking about is the devil, the Satan. Then I pondered and said to myself, is this he who made the heaven and the earth? And as he looked at the Avodah Zarah, he said, is it possible that this Stam Buba made the Shemayim Va'aretz? This sounds exactly like the Midrash of who? Of Avram. Word for word, these are Midrashim of Avram that Chazal have for us. The sea and us all, how will I know the truth? And in that night I lay asleep, a voice came to me and said, Yovav, Yovav. You recognize these words? Get up, rise up, and I will tell me the one that wishes to know. Avram, Avram, Vayomer Hineni, right? This, however, to whom the people bring burnt offerings and libations is not a god, but this is the power and work of the seducer, the Satan, by which he beguiles people. And when I heard this, I fell upon the earth and prostrated myself, saying, O Lord, O my Lord, who speakest for the salvation of my soul. Okay, here we start to get a little Christian. See, it's very difficult. You have old Midrashim that we believe in interwoven with the Christological effects. It's a very difficult book to read, but on the other hand, if you don't read it, you miss some beautiful, you can see where the ideas of Chazal came from. Or the, you know, it's like looking at the where the evolution was. I pray thee, if this idol of Satan, I pray thee, let me go hence and destroy it. Ah, yeah, he wants to go out and destroy the idols and purify the spot, for this is none that can forbid me doing this, as I am king of this land, so that those living will no longer be led astray. Now let's go to chapter 2. It's amazing. After this, I rose up at night and took 50 slaves and went to the temple of the idol and destroyed it to the ground. So I went back to my house and gave orders to the door that it should be firmly locked, saying to my doorkeepers, if somebody shall ask me, bring no report, but tell them he investigates certain affairs, he is inside. Then Satan disguised himself as a beggar, which means he broke Satan's idol, and then he went to his house and he locked the doors. He told nobody to answer the door because they knew the Satan would be coming right after him. Very Christological, right? But after this, there's this whole story about how the Satan came after him. Very nice. Now let's go to chapter 3. There's this confrontation with this guy Yovav, though, who lives in around Avram's time, and the Satan. Now let's take a look at chapter 3. For I had 130,000 sheep, and of these I separated 7,000 for the clothing of orphans and widows and needy and sick ones. He's not a modest guy. I had heard 800 dogs who watch my sheep besides these 200 watch my house. I had 9 mills working. The whole city carries ships to carry goods, and I seat them into every city, into the villages, to the feeble and the sick and those that were unfortunate. And I had 340,000 nomadic asses, and of these I set aside 500, and the offspring of these I ordered that he sold proceeds be given to the poor and the needy. This goes on. It's amazing. He goes on talking about himself for 2 chapters. And I never committed any sins, and I did this, and I'm a wonderful guy. Me, he's an unbelievable. He's describing step by step every Jewish act that he's done, but in no humble terms. He's sort of an anti-Avram. He does everything that we know of, all the things which we know about Avram and Medrash, he speaks about himself doing them in proud, no uncertain terms. So again, you have this kind of weird mix of this egotistical guy who's attesting to the foundation of his Judaism, and yet putting it in ways that we would never expect from our holy Torah. Chapter 12, he left 7 sons and 3 daughters.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
What happened in between?
Oh, tons of stuff. I'm just skipping. Much of the same story. Much of the same story, and then some other stuff. Interesting part where his wife goes and she complains to him because she had to go out and work for a living, and he's sitting at home crying and scratching all of his boils, and they have this whole argument between husband and wife. By the way, this argument between husband and wife shows up in post-Alexander literature. You find it in the book of Tobit, you find it in the book of Judith a little bit. You have this idea where the woman is has to go out and make a living,
which
and she yells at her husband.
Is supposed to be Dina,
this
or the first wife?
Supposed to be Dina.
Oh, the first wife is dead.
No, Dina.
No, because it says here, it's just in the same book, it says that his first wife died with the children, and the second group of children is from Dina.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
Which wife was out there working?
Yeah, I don't know. He left 7 daughters and 7 sons and 3 daughters. There were no daughters to be found in Sarah, his daughter of Job, so this mirrors our text. The name of the Job was formerly Yovav. He was called by Job Boron. He lived for his plague for 85 years, and the plague he took double of all, etc., etc., until our Lord be glory, amen. So there it lands off with a little amen to you know who. Okay, so what's interesting here, and I'll end off is it plays up this chapter that goes playing on this whole idea of Satan. And he goes and he breaks all the bubalas, and the Satan comes to get him. And there's a chazal which I'd like to read to you, and then I'll end the shiur with that. It's in this page, Talmud Bavli. Vayihi ayom, it's in the second paragraph on this page. Vayihi ayom, vayavo bnei Elohim v'tzatzev al Hashem. I'm quoting Eov, we actually did this last week. It was on that day, and the angels came to sit around God. Vayavo gama satan b'tachan, and the satan also came to it. Vayomer Hashem Satan, me'ayin tavo, where are you coming from? Vayana satan, etc. He tells him, I walked around the land. I've never found anybody who's as righteous as the original Avram. I'm going to give you land, and even though I told you I'm going to give you every piece of land, even though you told me he's allowed to have the whole land, when he wanted a place to bury Sarah, he wasn't going to take it for free, he was going to pay the price. And of course, the other famous story is the Lot story. Lot said, all the land is ours, I could take wherever I wanted. He said, that's not the way to behave. And Lot said, fine, I'm out of here. I can't behave any other way. Wait, what about Eov? Can't come over. Eov was in some ways better than Avram. Now I know that you're have God, fear of God. But Eov says, "Ish tam yashar yare Elohim v'sarim ra." He never did anything wrong, which means that Avram, there's a revelation. Now God knows that he truly fears God, but Eov always fears God. What does this medrash mean? Medrash doesn't mean that Eov is better than Avram. When did God say, "Ki ata yadati ki yare Elohim ata"? When were those words said? After what? After the Akedah. After he was willing to sacrifice anything and still remain true to God. And by the way, the original story, which I read a little bit last time, but if you take a look, that original story of the Midrashic story of the Akedah, do you remember how it is? The Satan comes over. He says, "I bet you won't sacrifice your son." And God says, "I will." And then he goes to Yaakov, to Yitzchak. He says, "Look what your father wants to do to you." And Yitzchak stands up. And at the end, who winds up killing Sarah? Do you remember the story? Satan runs over, which means our literature has what this non-Christian, but this sort of this apocryphal literature has, this conflict between the believer and the Satan. Am I going to keep my faith? Am I not going to keep my faith? And that's why I believe ultimately we have to go with Aram, because Aram, you don't have to go with Aram or Edom. Either way, they're all Semitic. They all come off of Avraham, and that's an important idea. However, what's interesting is right after the Akedah story, it says something very weird. Vayishma Avraham, that Nachor had all these kids. How many, you ever wonder how many kids Nachor, what, is that a weird story? What is, Vayugad la'Avraham ki Milka nolad banim? Well, who cares about Nachor? He's out of the picture. How many kids did he have? He had 12. Take a look at the Nachor story. Nachor has 12 kids, 8 from the wife and 4 from the Peleges, exactly like Yaakov of Eden. You see what's going on? There's a conflict here going on between the Aramites, Nachor's family, the Betuel family, the Lavan family, and the Avram family. That's not really for the sake of Eov, but I think Eov, as we read it, we'll have to keep in mind that idea. The idea, this is based on Avram's story. And you could see it, the whole Satan thing, the whole giving up, the whole, you know what, you thought you had everything? I'm not going to take everything away. I promised you everything, all the land with your son. I've already sent away Yishmael. This is the guy you trust. Kiss him goodbye. And the question is, what does a man do when he's asked to sacrifice everything? And there I think the comparisons are important. That's pretty much all I have. Next time we'll talk about the seven brothers and the three daughters and their party making.